Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's edition of the Mad Tech Podcast. I'm delighted to welcome our special guest for this session, all the way from Norway, Carl Thomas Peterson, who is client and agency manager digital for Nordic Entertainment Group. Hi, Carl.
Hiya. Hi, guys.
Delighted to have you. And I mean, listeners, Carl started this conversation before we started recording by telling Lindsay and I that he's just been for a dip in the fjords this morning. Mm.
Yeah.
Like that's a normal brilliant thing to do.
It is quite normal, actually. In Norway, you do go for a dip. But that's probably just a normal standard for our family. But yeah, as I said, the fjord is 200 feet away. It's just run on down and jump into the water. It's refreshing.
Spectacular. Yeah. Lindsay, do you have a similar morning routine over there in Walthamstow?
Oh, yeah, of course. It's a dip in the reservoir for me. Not the fjord. No fjords in Walthamstow, but plenty of reservoirs to have my luck with. So, yeah.
And I think I encountered a little bit of classic British summer weather, rain, pounding the streets of Streatham this morning on my run. So nowhere near as glamorous as what you've been up to, Carl. But
oh, that sounds great. Oh, did you pull out the old water bottle then, the heater bottle? I heard some discussions. A heater bottle.
And
there it is.
I've got the hot water bottle.
Rachel is holding a hot water bottle.
Oh yeah.
The temperature's got to get over 25 degrees for me to put the hot water bottle away. But anyway, I'm blaming my.
You. I'm sitting on an electric heated mat today, so I can't mock you at all.
There we go. I mean, it is actually cold in London this week.
Yeah, it is.
So it's not just my Southern Hemisphere heritage that's, making that difficult for me this week. Right, news stories of the week. First news story I wanted to chat with you guys about. Actually, I think this was released last week, late last week, but I was really keen to bring it forward to this week's discussion, which is that Facebook has invested in Indonesian super utility app Gojek. Now, Gojek, probably many listeners, particularly our listeners from Southeast Asia, will be very familiar with them. But for those who aren't, Gojek started out as a ride-hailing platform, very similar to Uber and also very similar to its biggest competitor in the Southeast Asian region, Grab, and is now growing to become, as I mentioned in my introduction, a super utility app. By that, we mean a platform that is enabling lots of different transactions, everything from food delivery through to perhaps personal services like domestic services and importantly, now they're trying to launch a digital payment facility. That is specifically what Facebook have invested in. The sum that they've invested hasn't been disclosed, but it's thought to be in the low hundreds of millions in US dollars. And they're interested in targeting for their investment GoPay, which is Gojek's payment platform. I'm finding this really interesting because that adds Facebook to a growing list of international tech companies that are investing in Gojek, including Google, but also Chinese companies Tencent and JD.com. And I guess it's also interesting because it sort of sets them as directly competitive, if they weren't already, to their nearest neighbour, Grab, who I mentioned. It's a very similar type of app, super utility app, who are also very keenly moving into the payment platform space. And there was a rumour a little while ago that actually Grab were potentially looking at acquiring Gojek, which just would have made that an incredibly big roll-up for the Southeast Asian region. But I wonder if this is actually going to now continue to set those two apart on their own individual competitive paths. So keen to know what you guys think about this. Facebook are looking, very sort of heavily at how they can grow and proliferate in the Asian marketplace. They've also made a recent investment in India telco broadband company called Jio. And so it feels like Facebook are really doing everything that they can to try to anchor not just their platform, but also extend their reach and their user base in the APAC region. And like I said, really interesting to sort of debate what we think this is going to do to that Grab-Gojek rivalry and the growth of the super utility platform in Asia, but also beyond Asia. Are we going to be in Western countries going to be looking to these utility apps as something that will become the staple of the way that we interact and contract individual services in our economies as well. Carl, what's your point of view on this story?
I would say it's a long time coming. I would Facebook's investment like this is really, I think it's absolutely natural way to go for them. They sort of stressed every other market that they're in. They haven't sort of utilized all the potential power except advertising and being a social media platform. But doing this, I mean, getting sort of the WhatsApp pay, getting the paid option, it's all about convenience, isn't it? And who sits behind every convenience aspect? When you sort of go into an international business area or you try to get payments through, you sort of fall down on the PayPal route, right? It's a very easy and convenient way. It's international known. So when the whole of Asian markets open up to this sort of way of buying and purchasing stuff, who's going to be the most convenient partner? So I think it's absolutely natural for Facebook to get in there, probably a little bit late in the game, but they're actively doing something. And I think that's positive for them. If they want to change some of the sort of the basis, the leg that they're standing on financially, they've got to make moves like this.
Yeah, that is a particularly interesting point, right? Is that this is, you know, this is a maneuver that's, you know, well outside the scope of ad monetization. And I suppose we've been watching Facebook trying to build some kind of a sort of financial platform for a while. They were launching their own cryptocurrency. That didn't go very well. They obviously have been looking at ways to utilize the WhatsApp platform for payment functionality and facilities as well. So you're right, you know, it does kind of feel logical, but that's also a good point. Maybe a little late in the game, because, you know, Lindsay, we've spent a lot of time out in Asia over the last couple of years. What's your view on this? Feels like Grab and Gojek have been growing, you know, exponentially for a couple of years now.
Yeah, they are behemoths of their region, basically. And I think I read somewhere that was very interesting, that was, and it ties in with what Grab are doing, what Gojek are doing, what Facebook are doing, and what Jio, who Facebook invested in India, which is, it was a perspective that said Grab and Gojek should get rid of their vehicles. Like, that's not where their money is now. It was a great, cheap, convenient way of getting an app on somebody's phone, on someone's device, and that is the best 1x1 centimeter piece of advertising you can have, is an app logo on your phone, and that enables you to then kind of become part of your user's conscience almost, and then you can then start trying to get them to do and use other things. And actually, if you think about it, that's what, if you look at other super utility apps like Line, they've done the same thing. They started out as a communications platform, a social media platform, and they've kind of gone into the payment realms as well. Looking into what Jio sells ridiculously cheap broadband and phone connections to then go into do the same thing. Interesting that Facebook are investing in the likes of Gojek from a payment perspective. And Facebook seemed to be particularly interested, if you look at the cryptocurrency and the stats they were coming out with for when they were launching that, and then them going off the Southeast Asian market and Indonesia specifically, is the unbanked world. And there's a stat I read that 27% of people in Southeast Asia have a bank account. That's it, 27%. The rest of them do not have a bank account. Yet these kind of non-bank account ways of payment, like WhatsApp Pay and the likes of Gojek and Grab, and there were other interesting ones like Paymaya in Philippines and Madeiri in Indonesia as well, are a way of being able to allow people to pay virtually without needing a bank account. And that feels to me that that's what Facebook is interested in. They don't care about people that don't have bank accounts, because there's no growth there, because there are already other brands that are doing that. Like in the UK, you've got Monzo, for example, that are going after people that have bank accounts and giving them more bank accounts. Actually, the opportunity of getting more money and more fees here is going after people that can go to their local shop, give them some cash that gets uploaded into a virtual e-cash or credit card, and then they can use that to pay for goods and services. And that seems where there's a huge e-commerce opportunity in Southeast Asia. And Facebook getting in here now, for me, is very interesting, because I thought that's their route to market.
And do you think that, because that's sort of what they touted Libra as being in the early days, they were wanting to really push it out into developing economies, to give developing economies that had otherwise been very cash-based a way to pay, you know, in a digital environment. So do you think that's one of the reasons they've gone after Gojek and GoPay? Because also, you know, in Indonesia, that's an enormous population, right? Just under 300 million people, same population as the US, effectively. And, you know, if only, say, 20, was that stat that you just mentioned, Lindsay, across Southeast Asia? 27%.
Yeah.
If only 27% of people have got bank accounts, that's an enormous number of people that you could be really targeting this at. Do you think that's where they're going with this?
Definitely. I don't think it's them trying to help connect the 73% that haven't got a bank account. Obviously, it's for them profitably where the opportunity lies. And in and of itself, it will then help connect an entire, you know, almost unconnected part of the nation, not just in communications with the likes of WhatsApp, but in being enabling to transact virtually via goods and services and not rely on cash. And Facebook could really win here.
Mm. And there's a second factor as well, and that's the explosion of smartphones within the Asian region. I mean, especially I had a convenient year in Thailand, sabbatical, that was 8 years ago. But the explosion of social media usage there is just extreme, and the it was quite slow with the smartphone sort of buying and selling there. But you can buy it in a 7-Eleven at the kiosk corner, basically anywhere in Southeast Asia. And it's a throwaway phone, and it's sort of the whole thing is built for communication on a social media platform. So if Facebook is big there from before, they can introduce this convenient sort of pay as you go. That's going to be amazing for them. So I understand the strategy. As you said, 300 million people, my God. It's an easy way to get a new system or a new service in.
And what do you think, do either of you have any views on the sort of concept of super utility apps and their usability in Western countries and Western economies? There's not the sort of, you know, trying to convert a cash dependent society to a digital, you know, payment environment incentive. But are there other reasons that apps that we've used before in the past that are now becoming a bit more utility oriented might look to try and build and grow that super utility functionality?
Be. I mean, for Norway's sake, we don't have Uber because it was basically shut down. That's because of the taxi industry. So we're a social democratic country. Everyone has their rights. If you're a working man within that, you have sort of your own organization of that sort of work culture. It's very difficult to get a big utility sort of app just to take over a lot of sort of industries that are already set because the government will come in and regulate. As happened with Uber. So there's a sort of more difficult way to enter that market in the Western world than especially Europe, than would be in Southeast Asia right now. I mean, GDPR is a perfect example of that. That just sets sort of the amazing barriers for the European market at once and makes it difficult for people to build basically super the apps, but payment functions within that. I mean, I think we've just seen the start of it, basically. And the services will come as the payment sort of rolls out. Just the discussion in Oslo and Stockholm has been around electrical bikes, the scooter bikes, how they sort of interfere with the day-to-day life, but it's really convenient. And you pay as you go, and you sort of just have an app, and you just, I'm going to ride this bike for 2 minutes. Great, pay, good, you're off. That sort of thing just sort of shakes the whole foundation of what we're doing as sort of northerners that we're sitting on our own sort of place and, oh, the big tech companies don't control much here. But they do. I mean, here it is, 2,000 kick bikes in the street that are electric. Wow, it shakes some foundations. So I think we're just seeing the start, but it's going to be a difficult ride.
That's interesting. Lindsay, what do you think? You know, there are probably other parts of European regions where maybe a utility app could work better. Anyway, tell me what your views are.
Possibly the likes of Eastern Europe, actually. If you think about Viber, and Viber is really popular in the likes of Eastern Europe and Latin America and Asia. And actually, it ties in really well to Carl's point about regulation. Actually, in Western Europe, in the States, there's so much regulation that actually a lot of these companies would try and develop these kind of super utilities and get shut down or get told to break it up. And we're seeing Google as a super utility company. It's not a one-size-fits-all app that can do everything for you, but it can provide many services for you in various guises. And we're seeing Google, you know, potentially getting broken up. If the US have anything to do with it, it might get broken up and separated into parts. And if that's happening to the likes of Google, any kind of, it does make sense that that's why the likes of Facebook would go after the Southeast Asian market and after kind of the unbanked lot, because there's less regulation there. They can do what they like, and they can create, they can go into a market with something cheap and easy like cars or bikes, and then use that to build a platform into something super utility. We haven't seen the same done in the West. We haven't seen Uber be able to create the same. They've been talking about doing those kinds of things for years, but actually we've not seen much evidence of it. So I do think that's an interesting point, regulation, because I would have said that legacy, of course, is a massive issue in the West as well. Like, there aren't the legacy payment systems in Asia generally, in the Asia Pacific region generally, not just Southeast Asia. There's no credit card system. So they've never had to kind of try and wean people off using credit cards. Like, that's a massive thing. In the West, even Apple Pay and Android Pay, they're still actually using credit cards. We aren't using virtual currency or a virtual card. We're using our own credit cards and our own debit cards within those platforms. So even that might look future facing, but it's not. It's not at all. Whereas in Asia, they haven't got any of those legacy systems or even payment systems for many people in the first place. So it's an opportunity. It is their first ever chance to pay for something without using cold hard cash, which we've had for God knows how long in over here. So it's a completely different set of challenges that people are trying to overcome. And I think that we might get there, but I think things like legacy and regulation will be blockers along the way and will take us much, much longer to get there than it has done in Asia.
Yeah. Payments is interesting. I mean, Carl, you alluded to this. See, I don't know what you think, Lindsay, but I am often looking at Scandinavian countries as kind of early adopters of technology solutions, actually. I think of them as very outward looking and very, open to challenge. And I think I can remember being in Sweden, in Stockholm, maybe even 8 or 9 years ago, and it virtually being cashless at the time, because there appeared to be no sort of legacy barriers in that regard. You know, they'd completely adopted the notion of digital payments via whatever channels were available at the time. Would you say that payments is an opportunity in places like Scandinavia because, Scandinavian countries adopt those sorts of solutions more readily than other European nations might?
Yeah, and I think there's an opportunity, but that's more on the international trade aspect of it. Because, I mean, locally, how banking sort of made their own payment system was very streamlined. That was very smooth transition. We have a platform called Vipps in Norway, which is basically paid on via app, connected to your accounts. Whether or not it's this or that bank, that's an important factor. So the banking industry sort of made that and were able to produce that kind of tech solution for everyone. But it doesn't change the fact that when we need to buy stuff overseas, I mean, it's heavily tolled. You've got to pay a lot more than the product you actually pay for. So if you buy books, for example, on Amazon, I can buy books for up to 300 and something krona, which is about £30 worth of books, and not get taxed. However, if I buy more than that, I get taxed, and I get taxed a lot, like 25%.
Wow.
Right. So you have this sort of, as that, I don't believe for the future that's going to stay like that, because it's going to be really difficult to regulate. They do it by post. I mean, the regulation is by post, basically. But as that sort of opens up more, you need more of an international stable sort of provider for payment. Now, is that going to be the ecosystem that we built banking-wise here? That one system connects to all the international ones, or vice versa. And I think that's a really interesting sort of way to look at it. How are the Scandinavian countries going to adopt to the international economy that way? But it won't be us sort of breaking ground internationally. We'll do it for ourselves locally. It's very
fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Really interesting. Right. I'm moving us on to second story of the week. This was a story about focusing in on a couple of specific examples as well about brands spending in advertising during the pandemic, but spending in alternative channels rather than, display, TV and out of home channels. I mean, for obvious reasons, particularly when we're talking about out of home, which is that people weren't moving around very much. Obviously, things are starting to change, but they're still not, back to the same sorts of levels of mobility that they would have been many months ago. And that in doing this, brands have been experimenting with spending more on dedicated influencer advertising opportunities and product placement opportunities in social media platforms. And I guess we touched on this a little bit when we talked about TikTok last week or the week before, didn't we, Lindsay? That was the Tic Tac week. I'm trying to remember whether that was last week or the week before. But anyway, the idea that perhaps brands are discovering a sort of new advertising opportunity, particularly in social media platforms where they might be in front of an audience that's a little younger and is very comfortable with that kind of unscripted ad hoc type of content, video content, whether that's user generated or whether that's something that's a little more formal. And that this is a way for brands to not only just be getting a brand message out there, but be potentially actually, attaching some real conversion metrics to those as advertising opportunities. So wanted to hear your thoughts on this, really. Do you think that we're going to start to see a couple of things happening in influencer marketing? The first being that there is perhaps going to be some more opportunities in influencer marketing for brands to get involved. And secondly, that there might be some more firm metrics attached to that, to those influencer opportunities, which will, you know, on the one hand, give influencers more legitimate reasons to be, you know, make an income off advertising, but also give advertisers a bit more opportunity to control those sorts of, advertising placements. And then I guess the following question from that is then what does it do to other more traditional channels of advertising? Carla, I bet you've got a lot to say about this.
Oh, I do indeed. And influencer marketing is something that I've been looking at for quite some time now. Because, I mean, what we do as a sort of a broadcast, we work a lot with YouTube. And YouTube's been doing this for ages and ages with the multi-channel networks that they're building. In Norway, I think we have two separate multi-channel networks off YouTube that owns their own clientele and they push brands in and stuff like that. What shocks me about this is the willingness of brands to pay so much more per view than they would traditional media. That's sort of, I don't know why, but it's really expensive to get a personality to sort of push your brand. And they're taking a lot of money off it. And it's been going on in Norway, it's been going on in Sweden, it's been going on for, I would say, 5-6 years. That's been building and building and building. And it sort of met sort of its top at about a year ago and sort of stayed there. But it's something which is building and building and building. The effect it'll have on traditional media, yeah, it'll take some budgets away. But whenever there's a new sort of media channel emerging, there's always something dying out. But the dying out in this sort of element would be sort of the traditional display formats that you would normally just pay and pay and pay for, like the top banner or the side banner or whatever. Maybe that'll scoot away a little bit. You'll communicate in a different way, change your strategy, and then get the influencers to sort of get people directly to your brand page. For TV, for sort of the big moving sort of reach channels, I don't think it'll have that much to say because TV's been doing this for a long time, just in a different version of it, like product placements within TV programs and all the tech that's been worked around that. That's sort of that's so built in, the sponsorship element on TV. It's so built in and heavily profiled on the profiles that you have in the programs that I don't think that's going to have sort of the big impact. It begs to see, I mean, during the COVID season, especially in the Scandinavian countries, TV was on the rise and it's been loads of viewing and people really sat down to the TV screens and watched. However, as is natural, brands sort of stop investing in large campaign material because, I mean, do you want to risk that? Do you want to be the brand that just everything's normal while the world sort of goes down the drain? We've been talking heavily to the larger clients within the Nordic region to sort of understand how much it costs to drop large reach campaigning and branding. So if you stop that, the cost of building it again is massive. So just changing strategy so to go to influence and taking the risk of the influencer doing exactly what you want them to do, because that's sort of the play you have to have. You can't tell them what to do. You just have to guide them, try to guide them, but that wouldn't be right. So I think it's a really it's a platform on the rise, but it'll take time. And I think it needs to be more controlled until it takes over completely to another sort of possibility. But it's a platform. It's there. It's being used, but it's really expensive.
Yeah, that's interesting. Lindsay, what's your point of view?
I think Carl hit the nail on the head talking about it's a risk, and you have to, many brands don't like losing control, and they'll put money into channels they feel they have control over or they feel they understand. And influencer marketing could probably feel a bit more like a dark art still at the moment. And you're having to rely on the influencer to do what you want to do. And they could go off piste. They could themselves, as personalities, get in trouble more general. You know, the famous influencer Logan Paul for taking a picture of a dead body in that Japanese suicide forest. And all the brands that were associated with him could have got a lot of backlash for that. So you have to be really careful who your money's going to. And anyway, as Carl mentioned, it's still in terms of a form of media, it's very unregulated. And there's the backlash about making sure that everything on social media is tagged as an ad or tagged as a gift or whatever. That's still not really, there's obviously more rules around that the platforms are having to implement, but it's still not really particularly well enforced, and there's still lots of problems with it. And I think that the other thing about brands putting money into influencers is that it is still, nobody would still really know where it sits as a channel. Many brands that, you know, say for big retailers might have a performance marketing team and then a brand team, which is more like a brand product team, and they have all the branding, you know, fluffy metrics go in there, where they would do all of their own social media, and that might be where influencers go. But actually, should the work that influencers are doing be held more accountable and not be looked at with kind of fluffy engagement metrics? Should we be putting more of a performance lens on influencer marketing? And if we did do that, then maybe that would help bring more control to it as well, and people wouldn't, and maybe the cost of a product being sent to an influencer, or of course an influencer advertising your product, could come down. I mean, there's stats about, you know, for example, Love Island, a big show in the UK, how much after they've come off the show, they might get £5,000 for one post on one product. Some might get £10,000. The Kardashians get millions for one post. And because there's no real way of being able to properly track what that actually drove, those numbers can keep going up, because as that person's personality goes up and their influence goes up, they can charge more. But actually, if you put more performance-based metrics on it, you would start seeing that come down, and you would start seeing it be more regulated. And I think that's probably the future. But it's interesting using it during lockdown, because I read something recently that there are many influencers that are really struggling, because obviously they might have influenced things like, they might have made their money through travel, or made their money through kind of wearing nice clothes out and about. And now all they can wear is loungewear, and they can't go out and about. And there's, you know, they've lost a lot of money through that. And there's also been a lot of stuff around influencers' mental health, and, you know, the tie up with that and brands is a real struggle. My brother, as a little roundtree anecdote, my brother works in hospitality. Obviously, he's been furloughed, but as a side hustle, you could class him as an influencer. Basically, he just likes eating lots of food. Then he goes out to a lot of restaurants. And since lockdown started, he has been sent insubordinate amounts of food, not from big brands, but from local restaurants or local companies or local delis and stuff that, you know.
Really?
Yeah. So you've got Hacker Sandwich, which is a well-known restaurant in London, doing their tasting menu at home. They send him a tasting menu. The Dorchester, a very well-known hotel, doing afternoon teas. They do afternoon teas at home.
We've got to get round to Dom Roundtree's house.
Absolutely right, yeah. But he doesn't he doesn't get paid for it. He's not that kind of influencer, because he doesn't do it as a job. It's not a career. But he gets all his food. And, you know, if just three people buy that from having seen it on his Instagram feed, then it's been worth them sending him that stuff. And there's a lot of brands that will take that risk, but you'll see a lot of direct-to-consumer brands that will take that risk, because they'll go, I've got product, I'll send it. But the bigger brands that want to be able to see direct metrics and want to be able to know where their product's going will not be quite as ready to do that.
So that was what was interesting. That was going to be my next question, and I should have mentioned this when introducing the story. It was a story that appeared on Bloomberg, and the example that they used of the brand that was really experimenting with influencers was Barilla, the Italian pasta brand. Now, that is a traditional pasta brand, right? I mean, I guess maybe it's the type of product that's perhaps a little easier to insert into an influencer environment, but they were just talking about the immense uplift they got from having a well-known personality kind of documenting what you know, a sort of a day or part of a day in the life of lockdown was like, and the meals that she was making herself and the brand of pasta that she was using, and it worked perfectly for them. And it then made me think, would you see more traditional brands, obviously dependent on what it is they're selling, maybe get a little bit more experimental with this? Firstly, because, you know, the pandemic's perhaps funneled them into it, but secondly, because it might be a way to turn this into much more of a legitimate, you know, form of advertising and marketing that comes with metrics attached to it. Do you think we're going to see that?
By far. And I think a lot of big brands are doing it. I don't see the influencers that much. But for the target group that you're trying to reach, I mean, it's absolutely necessary to be there. In an influencer way or connected to an influencer. I think it's something the big brands do already. But the thing is, it will never change the sort of a good media plan. Won't be changed by an influencer's sort of KPIs, what they bring to the table. I think that's a side budget that's just, all right, we need to find money for this as well. Because that underscores, that builds, everything you build with a campaign will then be sort of built into what the influencer does. So I think that's important. Oh, that's my dog, by the way. Sorry.
Oh, excellent.
Hi, Carl's dog.
Yeah, Lindsay's got a dog too. Oh, you can tell what's going to feature in this week's podcast picture, listeners, the hot water bottle and the two dogs.
Yeah, little old Sonia. You'll get a picture of her.
Oh, excellent. I can't wait.
So influencer marketing, it's here to stay. It's going to be built on. I think the good thing, what Lindsay was talking about, the regulation aspect of it, I think it's really, really difficult. Like in television, you have Ofcom. It regulates how many hundreds of channels. If you get busted, you get a fine. You don't want to break the rules. But can Ofcom, is that sort of the regulative way to go with 1-2 million influencers? How are you going to control that? And ask them to put a P for product placement. Whenever they put out a video, they're never going to do that. It's really a difficult lane to go down. I think it's here to stay, but it's to regulate it. My God, I don't want to be the person in charge of that.
It then makes me also wonder what the interaction will be like with on social media platforms with these products. I mean, I guess that's maybe more of a question about advertising in general, but I just think if you're a young person and you're following influencers because you like particular things about them, but they're just constantly pushing products your way, wouldn't you stop listening after a while? Wouldn't you just tune out and think, yeah, you're just doing that? Because I suppose I'm wondering if there is any element of cynicism that might be seeping into the world of influencer marketing now that people know that the Kardashians get paid millions for one post, or that, you know, the average, you know, relatively well-known influencer will get paid a lot of money for one small post. Do people believe it?
Yeah, I think, I mean, for us, I'm going to be cynical here, because for us, like, we're grown men and women. We sort of have seen and see what the world, how the world plays everything with branding and how they want to sort of influence you with the choices that you make. But for kids.
Yeah, you're right. Young people.
Yeah. Anyone from 10 to somewhere in the 20s will be influenced. They won't have the same understanding. I think if you push too hard, sure, they will go, oh my God, you're doing too much. But I see my 10-year-old. He plays Fortnite, and he plays, the names on the games I don't remember anymore.
You're not a Fortnite specialist, Carl.
I am indeed. I'm quite a good sniper myself. but the thing is, he watches so much Twitch and YouTube with all these big stars, and whenever he wants sort of a gadget for his gaming, it's so heavily influenced. Like, it's what kind of headset you want. Oh my God, I have to have that. There's no discussion that it's a particular brand with a particular story. He wants that because that person uses it. So that kind of influence, I think, will be much more seeping through and making sure that the decisions that are made and the influences that are made goes to very, very targeted audience, and you make a lot of money from them. Because I don't know what I'm buying. If I'm buying a headset, I'm lucky to get something that works. But my son knows exactly what he wants and how it looks.
Yeah.
That sort of influencer marketing is going to keep on going. It's something my kids grow up knowing about this. They know they're influenced. They don't care. But for us, I mean, I'm 45. can't fool me anymore. If I'll have Coke, I'll drink Coke. Thank you very much.
No fooling us oldies. Lindsay, nah. You're a bit younger than us. What do you think?
I mean, I'm trying desperately to be in the head of a younger person. I've so looking at things like TikTok, understanding how it works, and looking at influencers. And I don't personally get it, but it's this aspirational thing, right? And it's this people looking at that going, yes, I want that. I want to be that. Like my friend, my brother is costing him a fortune because my brother is getting all this free food and he's advertising it and talking about it on the likes of Instagram. And my friend is buying it because he wants that food. So they're, you know, influence, and he is a grown man that should know better, but he's still, yeah, still getting it. It's still not aspirational. Like I must be like your brother and eat the same food as him, but it is like, that food looks amazing, I want it. And
yes, not being able to resist temptation.
Yeah, and the same will apply to things like fashion and those kind of things that the younger people are attracted to with the likes of influencers. There was I remember watching a TV show years, years ago, and this was before streaming was really taking off, so actually the likes of product placement in TV now has probably taken over and is much more interesting. But there was a someone called Charlotte Dawson, who is a former Geordie Shore character in the UK. And she, as everyone in social media, in reality TV in the UK does, you either come out of the TV show with a teeth whitening deal on Instagram, or you do a workout video. And she did a workout video called something like 3 Minute Belly Blitz or whatever it was called. And they said, right, let's get you everywhere. Let's get you all over TV. And they put her on This Morning, which is a really popular UK TV show, morning TV show on every morning on ITV. Put her on This Morning, expected to get like thousands and thousands of sales off the back of her appearing on this and talking about her brand new workout video, and she got like nothing, like didn't move the needle, nothing happened. And then she put out one tweet and got like 3 million sales on the back of it.
No.
And they were, and it was, I remember that being then like, ah, okay, social media is something here. We can't rely on TV, because her audience is not watching This Morning. And yeah, that was like a penny dropping moment in the UK about influencer marketing. I'll never forget watching it because it was so just like, oh yeah, right. And that has just exploded ever since. And I think that there's a lot to be said for the power of influencers, but there is also a lot to be said for the cynicism coming forward, particularly during lockdown, of these influencers promoting these amazing lives. And this has happened a lot with celebrities as well, the massive backlash of their amazing lives and their amazing houses. And them going, I've been made redundant, I've been furloughed, I can't afford this stuff. Stop pushing it. I'm not going to follow you anymore because I don't believe in what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just thinking about the only influencer that I follow on Instagram, and I can't even remember the story as to why I'm following him, but actually it's his cat's account. It's called Simon the Adventure Cat, and it's this guy who lives in Boulder in Colorado, and he's got this cat that he takes with him everywhere. And so he goes kayaking and he takes the cat with him. He goes for a run and he's got the cat in this kind of little rucksacky thing that sits on his back, and he jogs. Yeah, I know it's ridiculous. Listeners, if you could only see the face of Carl and Lindsay right now. But the thing is, during lockdown, in the odd time when I'd look on Instagram and a Simon the Adventure Cat, you know, video would come up. The cat video, the bit with the cat in it, great. But his owner unboxing some new product in this beautiful house that he's living in the middle of the mountains in Colorado. I was like, I don't want to see this. This is just annoying, right? Cat videos, yes. Amazing life, no. Not interested.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's quite good. I'm obviously not the demographic for influencer marketing, but yeah, it's interesting. We could keep going on this, but I'm going to move this on. Otherwise, we're going to run out of time. So third story of the week. Actually, we covered this in one of our Exchange Wire daily roundups, which is a Bernstein analyst named Tony Sakanagi recommending that Apple should buy the search engine DuckDuckGo. So I wanted to basically get people's opinions on this because I just think it's really interesting. The idea is that, you know, DuckDuckGo is a sort of independent, privacy-first search engine. And the suggestion is that, you know, it's a perfect type of product for Apple, who are also often heavily play on the notion of protecting user data and user privacy. I know that's debatable amongst some, but anyway, that's one of their tickets. And the notion is that if they were to purchase this search engine, then perhaps they could reinvest the something in the region of $7 to $8 billion a year that they pay to Google to power the search functionality in iOS as the operating system on iPhones, and instead they could be investing that in the acquisition of DuckDuckGo and seeing what that does for them in terms of owning a much more powerful search engine and all of the potential opportunities that they've got with that, and the, you know, sort of wider, more broader reach and the search possibilities. Is this crazy or is this interesting? And would Apple really consider this? What do you think? Lindsay, I'm going to ask you first. You've got a very broad smile on your face. It's going to be another, like the Queeby rant last week, which was brilliant.
My Queeby rant, yeah. Oops, sorry, everyone. I think Apple could buy DuckDuckGo like 207 times over with the billions they've got in cash reserves. So they could easily do this. And it's a really interesting idea. Like, do I think it's going to happen? No, because... I think largely, and first of all, this analyst reckons that Google wouldn't give a shit about this. They think that Google would happily give up that $8 billion fee they're getting from Safari and the $15 billion in profit they get from being the key search engine on Safari, because they don't think that Bing would take over anytime soon, and that'd be fine, because as long as it's not Bing, Google don't really care. I don't agree with that. I think Google would care, and Google would still
want to. I think so too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It doesn't make any sense to me. But also, I think that Google is ubiquitous with search engines. Like, and if I am an iPhone user, I do use Safari, which is very strange, because I use Chrome everywhere else, but I do use Safari. And if the search engine was no longer Google, I would just use Chrome and use that there. And I think a lot of people do the same thing. I think that Apple's marketing message here around safety and privacy is much more aligned with DuckDuckGo, 100%. I can't disagree with that, versus Google. And Google has so much trouble for its search business in the US and across other markets that actually Apple would do well to separate themselves from them, because they're just not aligned on that front whatsoever. So that it would be interesting from that perspective. And if Apple were to buy anybody, DuckDuckGo would be a great option. And actually, talking of advertising during lockdown, it seems to be the one brand doing out-of-home advertising. I see their billboards absolutely everywhere in London. So
DuckDuckGo.
Yeah. So I think they're obviously going for a push themselves at the moment. I don't know. It's definitely a game of two halves in terms of potential, because, yes, on the one hand, it could be a possibility. On the other hand, I don't think Google would let it happen. And I think that it would just be – it would. One of the questions that you asked kind of in the briefing note, Rachel, was the impact of advertising. For an advertiser, as someone that started my media business in paid search, thinking about the attention Google gets as an advertiser versus the attention that Yahoo and Bing got. Yahoo and Bing got no attention because it was such a small aspect of our search marketing budget. And we would obviously run campaigns through it, but it was like 5-10% versus 90% going to Google. And as a result, a lot of the optimization efforts would go to Google, because Yahoo and Bing were just more of a faff to have to upload everything into. Obviously, there are tons of platforms out there that enable you to optimize all of them in one go, but it would still just be, it wouldn't get the same attention, despite the fact that Yahoo and Bing frequently came out as having more valuable results and more valuable, higher net worth users were using them, and you'd get better conversion rates on Yahoo and Bing. Mm. And you might find the same with DuckDuckGo as well, because actually, when you look at device separation, iOS normally is a higher value user than Android. And if you look at the breakdown of who is an iOS user versus Android user, that plays true. If you were to combine DuckDuckGo with that, you would definitely find that you'd have overall a greater ability to target iOS kind of higher value, even though you can't do any tracking on it. You could actually just sort of guarantee that you have a higher value user there than you would do on any Android device and Android and Google search engine. So from that perspective, it could be interesting, but it would not get as much attention as Google would, because Google is still ubiquitous as a search engine. You're not going to go, I'm going to DuckDuckGo this, I'm going to Google this. And I can't see that working. I don't think Apple would do that. I don't know.
Carl?
I hope they'll do that.
It would be exciting, right?
Yeah, because I'm in this sort of the search engine sort of field. I mean, DuckDuckGo is still sort of the underdog. It's still the little man, and I'm sort of rooting for them to go. Go on, boys! I mean, work this in, and I think it's a funny thought. Apple buying them and then sort of making money off the ad revenue from DuckDuckGo instead. it would fit much better with the privacy policy. I totally agree with Lindsay. And I think as a third perspective, I think the difficulty with doing this is all the other favorable aspects that you have within the iOS system that Google brings into the fraction. I mean, your map allotments, your placements, every sort of the 360 sort of version of Google that's sort of implemented within the iOS system, that falls away. I think for Apple, that's going to be really, really difficult to swallow, because that means that either DuckDuckGo is going to have to sort of make everything from scratch, like these services that are well built and have people already signed into, or Apple's going to have to do it themselves. But yeah, I say go, do it yourself.
You say DuckDuckGo.
Yeah, I do say DuckDuckGo. Go for it. Oh, bless you, boys. Come on, girls.
So, yeah, well, that's you and Kieran. Kieran is really excited about this notion. He was talking about it for days, wasn't he, Lindsay?
That should,
in Kieran, true Kieran fashion, expletive warning, that should definitely fucking happen. That should definitely fucking happen. So, yeah.
Cool. You sort of think, like, well, would Apple want to get into the search business? Is that really what they're about? But actually, you know, they've already got a very strong search engine in the form of the App Store.
Yeah.
And they're used to that and the algorithms and, you know, ASO App Store optimization and running paid ads and paid media through it, within the App Store, it's big business for them. So to be able to transfer their expertise on that over to a search engine where DuckDuckGo have the privacy aspect sorted would be really interesting.
Here's a tip for Apple then. Sorry, Rachel.
No, for
Apple. Combine it with Siri so that if you tell Siri to quack quack, you automatically search something on DuckDuckGo. I mean, it's perfect. Quack quack, Siri. Go on.
That is a great idea. There we go, Apple. We've just given you, and that's trademarked by Carl.
Oh, it is actually, yeah. Waiting for your call, guys.
I mean, but the one final thing on this before we move on, the advertising angle is interesting, though, because there's many reasons as to why advertisers might be nearly ready to move to an environment where you are targeting less but more valuable users rather than going for that broad reach, right? Now would be the time.
Yeah.
And also the ghost of cookie death, which sort of follows Google around everywhere, that sort of disappears, doesn't it, when it comes to Apple buying DuckDuckGo. That's quite exciting. Mm. That shakes things up. And then all of a sudden you have sort of possibility for all tech systems sort of pulling themselves over DuckDuckGo to be that we're sort of the system to solve everything for you now, because you're going to have a whole set of international companies wanting to buy the tech that can actually utilize that search engine, not Google's system. It's quite interesting. I like it. Yes.
Yeah.
Carl on board.
I was about to say, Carl's on board. You've got a big fan here, Apple, DuckDuckGo. He'd be key advisor here. Great. Let's go to the second part of the podcast before we run out of time, which was just to an opportunity to have a little bit of a chat with you, Carl, about what you're up to, what you're up to at Nordic Entertainment Group. We started before we started recording, we started talking about some exciting stuff that you're doing, working with another broadcaster there in Norway and trying to get, if you like, a bit of a consortium for broadcasters via a buying platform, via a unified single SSP. Tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, so the plan is, I mean, we work heavily with, I mean, live living images. That's sort of the aspect that we go on. And for us, the quality parameter of what we're providing the desks or the programmatic buy, that's sort of not that heavily weighted as we'd want it to be. Because our service is basically, it's full screen, its viewability is fantastic. So when we sell that in a programmatic environment, what normally happens is that you place on a list where YouTube is present and Facebook is present and maybe some outstream locations, some in-video or video in display sort of buys are present. And then price-wise, we sort of fall out because that's not really as good as all the other video products. And what we're trying to do now is sort of form together in order to say that, well, looking at a perspective of quality, and that's basically how many seconds do you watch something to get a message across, and what size do you watch that in, is effectiveness. And we got loads of research coming from Australia, coming from all over the world, saying that the video in that sort of aspect is has much higher sort of efficiency than a lot of the other video products. So what we wanted to do was sort of, okay, could we as a standard, could we as a duration move into having aspect or parts of our inventory pooled together where the highest quality of inventory could be offered in one SSP? That was the general sort of basis for it. So a lot of the problems that arise from that is that, well, one of the publishers, they have, one of the broadcasters have one ad system. We have a third, and the third one has a second one. It all sort of, it's not combined at all. And the ad tech companies, they don't want to talk to each other. They say they want, I mean, they try. But when it comes deep down into the system, especially programmatically, they just don't want to. The systems don't align. So that was a problem for us. So luckily, in as of the Norwegian market, we have two broadcasters on the same ad tech stack, which enabled us to sort of pool it together. And we found a way to sort of, using the third broadcaster's ad tech company, to sort of pool the same kind of quality inventory into the same mesh. And that's what we're trying to do, is just to offer the trading desks a possibility to buy quality reach from broadcasters. So we're going to hope is to call QBR, quality broadcast reach. But it takes a long time to get all the sort of ad stacks to work together in order to pool it the right way, because there's so many sort of traps and issues that fall into this. That gets difficult. Now, luckily, all the political aspects have sort of been worked through, because this is something that we're going to try out in Norway. Then hopefully we'll be able to build it for a Scandinavian or possibly a Nordic sort of region, sort of pooling of inventory, which would be the highest quality video impressions bought programmatically. And that would be fantastic. But it's still a little way off, but all the details are there, and we have a third party sort of completely independent advisory who sets the whole SSP up for us. So that's completely independent. Everything's sort of legally, the aspect of legal wise, it's, everything's good. But there's so much work to be done when it comes to the ad techs actually wanting to cooperate on our behalf. And that's, as a publisher, I think that's really difficult to get across, because we need you to cooperate on our behalf, not on your own.
That's really interesting, because, you know, we've been talking a lot over the last, well, I would say even 12 months, about perhaps certainly the relationship between the sort of the tech layer, the buy side and the sell side, and who's coming more closely together and who's facilitating those relationships, right? And so this is interesting, because you're painting here a story of collaboration amongst broadcasters and, you know, a desire to pull together, you know, some form of inventory that's based on quality. And presumably you've got one piece of the tech puzzle, right, because you're able to set up a unified or a single SSP platform. So you've been able to kind of get that side of the tech functionality going. But now you need the buy side tech functionality to be aligned as well, right? And I'm assuming that you're getting some, well, I suppose it's a question to you, how are your customers, how are the advertisers responding?
Very positively. It's most of all, it's, oh, finally, that's sort of the reaction. And I think that's sort of what we want to hear as well. It's an oh, finally moment, but it's, We've come so far now that we tried to do initial tests, and I'm not going to say that we've done, from the broadcasting perspective, we're all done and good. Certainly some new challenges arose when we found out we don't measure viewability the same way. So that's an aspect that sort of, we need to align that, and then we have to align this. And then you have the buy side of it, where you have the really, really large tech stack owners who really wants to own this themselves. And that's the problem that sort of comes in, because we could go to a supplier like Google, we could go to a supplier like SmartClip or SpotX, they'd work fine for us, but you'd only have the aspect where all the clients are in one major big Google buy zone. And that's when Google wants to own the whole process themselves, something happens and it gets really difficult. That's not to say, I mean, for us using Freewheel, it's not an easy sort of conversion to get SpotX to be able to buy from Freewheel and stuff like that. It's the difficulties and across all sort of layers. But it's far more political than it's actually achievable. I think it should be plug and play. I'm saying this because I'm not an engineer. I'm not a data engineer, but it should be more plug and play than this. But it's not. So my sort of heart cries out for more collaboration in the face that we're not going to make money in the future if we don't sort this out.
Mm. It is interesting because we've also been talking about this from the point of view of, you know, connected TV and any inventory basically, you know, sort of bought and sold in that you know instantly consumed TV environment is a real opportunity for ad tech companies. But like I said, you know, this is a bit of a story from your point of view of ad tech companies not necessarily wanting to play together on this. It's good news that maybe some of the smaller, less dominant companies, not necessarily small, but, you know, not the Googles of the ad tech space have been willing to collaborate because they can clearly see the value in it. But, you know, it just begs the question, where are the opportunities and for whom, right? Because I suppose one of the other issues around connected TV has been, from an advertiser point of view, reach, but yet that's what you're looking to solve with bringing together, pooling inventory through one funneled SSP, right? So,
I mean, reach is an issue now, right? So for one publisher or one broadcaster perspective, reach is a problem right now. It won't be in the future as more CTV and connected TV, addressable TV impressions come along. That will grow exponentially over the next 3 years a lot, because what you have within the subscription-based offerings that the broadcasters have is you don't have much advertising coming through live now. I mean, people buy subscriptions just to get away from it. But with sports comes opportunity because, I mean, when you show NHL, NFL from the States on Nordic platforms, you get an ad break, which just basically says this is an ad break, and you get it for 3 minutes. So you're watching a live sort of, you're watching something live in the States. It's a black screen saying advertising. So what do you do with that? We have the opportunity now to place breaks in it. The server-side implemented break patterns. But we're not there yet to sort of start implementing it on a large scale until we know and understand what happens within people's understanding of it. Because many people will automatically go, hey, I'm paying 10 quid a month not to see this. I'm actually having the sports pack. Maybe I'm paying 30 quid a month. I'm not supposed to see advertising. But within the sports section, there is huge opportunities because they would actually more assume that it's natural for the break to come within a live viewing incident than a program. So that's where the opportunities are. And I think we're going to more and more push it that way. And as soon as we can pool that inventory together and offer it on as a sort of, this is TV advertising bought now, not as a rating, not as a rating point, but as a CPM buy, a digital buy, that's when it gets interesting. That's when it really, really pushes money. And unless we have the right cooperations from the tech side on this, it'll take longer and longer to happen. And then in a while, if nothing happens, we're going to sit here 5 years down the line saying, well, whatever happened to CTV?
Yeah. Missing the opportunity. Lindsay?
Yeah, it's interesting because it's interesting hearing it from a broadcaster saying that they want to invest in CTV and they see an opportunity for it to happen. And we're still in early days. And if the tech is on board with us making this a thing, then we can see this scaling massively. Because we have this conversation in Europe, obviously, quite a lot with ATS, Rachel, like for Germany, like for France, and obviously the UK as well. And depending on what country you're having the conversation in, it'll be the broadcasters telling you that there isn't really a VOD opportunity, there isn't really a CTV opportunity. And the streaming platform is the one saying that is where, you know, that is where the inventory is and that's where the scale is, and that's where the money is. So, I mean, do you think that is there a blocker from it coming from a broadcaster and the legacy challenges you have of being a more traditional broadcaster? You mentioned ratings versus CPM there. Will that stop you from scaling it outside Norway?
It might. I think the biggest sort of holdback from the broadcasting perspective is we don't know how clients react, right? The last thing we want to do is lose viewers because we did something stupid. Like in Norway, for example, we don't advertise alcohol on television at all because we know that that would change stuff. We would lose viewers by doing that. So that aspect hanging over everything, us being as regulated as we are on top of everything. When we do stuff on the OTT sort of platforms, can we go a little bit further? Is that politically correct? Now, when we shake everything up and hold everything in our hands, the thing that falls down first is the one that you make less money off. And that, as per now, would be CTV. That would be just a fun sort of experiment to do. But it wouldn't be something that we put the highest up on the list for making revenue in the future. But from my perspective, personally, that would be a growth value that you would put right into somewhere you could utilize now. So you could push and push and push to get advertisers to buy that platform. Because that will happen. I think for brands, big international brands, buying Norwegian consumed live TV digitally, that would be really interesting. And price wouldn't be a point. That wouldn't be within the KPI. It was just, I want to reach that viewer. That would be the most important thing. So, yeah, I think if we argue this right, if we work this right, if we can prove something with this, yeah, it's going to move. But it's going to take some working together, and it's going to take some sort of, you have to show the big boys on top. How are you going to make money in 10 years, not just now in 2 months? So, yeah, that's the big difficulty with it. And it's a lot of meetings away and it's a lot of pushing away. But it's going to slowly happen. And the biggest thing for us then is to have everything that's sort of the fundament for making this work, the tech part, the SSP part, the trading desks and everything, that has to be in place. So when we flip the switch, it all moves the right way. But it's difficult. It's politically difficult and it's structurally difficult. But it's going to happen. I'm positive. I'm very positive. After that, I'm going to start up a duck quack quack show myself.
Awesome. There's actually, I often say this at the end of podcasts, but we've just been having some really interesting conversations during these lockdown podcasts, and that's one of them. And I'd like to go into a bit more detail, but we don't have time to do it now. And so I'm going to have a chat with you, Carl, about having a separate podcast special conversation about the world of connected TV in the Nordic region. But in the meantime, thank you very much for coming and joining us today. Thank you very much, Lindsay. Thank you very much to your respective dogs for hanging around and being dog-like in the background. And thank you very much for listening. That was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.